Hi, I'm Piper.
And I'm Erin.
Welcome to Off the Tracks podcast, where we explore what it means to do law differently.
Today, we are joined by Samantha Peters. Samantha is a lawyer and the current director of legal initiatives and public interest at Black Femme Legal, the national vice president of equity and anti-oppression at the Canadian Association of Labor Lawyers, a member of the City of Toronto's Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, Queer, and Two-Spirit Council Advisory Board, and a volunteer lawyer at the 519. She is also an LLM candidate at Queen's University Faculty of Law, specializing in political and legal thought. Samantha previously served at the University of Ottawa Faculty of Law's first ever Black Legal Mentor in Residence for the 2020-2021 academic year. Samantha is a frequent commentator and writer on topics such as workers' rights, sexual and gender-based violence, social policy, and critical race theory in Canada. Her commentary and writing on these issues have been featured in the Toronto Star, Global News, Flair, and other newspaper and broadcast outlets, including CBC Sunday. In 2020, her essay titled Making Social Context Education Mandatory, Why Cultural Competency Should Matter in the Courtroom, won the Canadian Bar Association's Women's Lawyers Forum's inaugural Writing Her In competition. We are so grateful to be kicking off our 2022 episode with Samantha. So we are so grateful that you are here with us, and we are just so excited to learn everything that you have to share with us.
Thank you both so much for having me. I'm super excited.
So Samantha, you've had like just such a cool career so far, and you're someone who, not to sound weird, but like I've just seen you online all the time. And yes, I just thought, like, this is someone doing really important work, but also my perception has always been not only is Samantha doing important work, but it seems like work that she's really passionate about and she paves her own path. And you're just really cool. We would love to hear a bit more about how your career has evolved over time and how you've carved out a niche of things you're passionate about and also, frankly, things you're really good at.
Thank you so much. Wow. So I guess I can start off by the fact that I went to law school wanting to practice law differently. And it's because before starting law school, I actually worked at the Ontario Bar Association for a few years. And so in working there, I was able to interact with lawyers on the daily. And I just realized that the traditional way of practicing law was not necessarily the lifestyle that I wanted. No shade to folks that love that, but it just wasn't me. And so I went to law school, not really knowing where I would want to work, but knowing that I wanted to do something different. And so when a lot of folks were, you know, applying for OCI positions and stuff, I was instead looking at, okay, are there fellowships? Are there internships? What can I do differently? So my first year summer, I got a social justice fellowship from the University of Ottawa Faculty of Law, and I got to work at Sanctuary for Families in New York City, which is a gender-based violence organization. And I also got to work at the African Canadian Legal Clinic. It no longer exists, but it's pretty akin to what the work that the Black Legal Action Center is doing now. And after my first summer, I was like, this is how I want to practice law, right? Like, I don't necessarily want to be in a law firm. This is what I wanted to do. So in my second year summer, I got to work at the Law Commission of Ontario. I also got to work at South Ottawa Community Legal Services. And then I articled at QP National. I didn't start practicing right away because I wasn't called to the bar with my peers. So I was like, what do I do? And I did a lot of contract work at the intersection of law, politics, and policy. And I ended up doing some contract work for a political party, which turned into me working as their anti-harassment officer during the 2018 provincial elections in Ontario. And then thereafter, I ended up working as a legislative researcher at the Legislative Assembly of Ontario, which was a super cool job. But after a while there, you know, I was speaking to politicians and they were like, why don't you just write the bar? I'm like, if only it was that easy to pass it. but then I figured, why not? So because the process here in Ontario was just not working for me in the way in which I learned, I decided to move to Alberta. So I moved to Edmonton and I went to the CPLED program. And then I was called to the Bar of Alberta in 2020, and then also called to the Bar of Ontario in the same year.
That is such a neat trajectory, and what a cool variety of different positions that you are able to take on. One thing that I'm interested in is, how are you able to find these positions? Was there any support at your law school for finding these sorts of different roles, or was it mostly sort of self-led research to find these unique positions outside of the traditional OCI process?
I think it was a little bit of both. So when I knew what kind of areas of law that I was interested in, I would just Google, just like criminal social justice, Toronto law, and just see what would pop up. Right. And then I created a list of lawyers that I may want to work with and organizations that I was interested in working with. And then thereafter I went to my law school and I was like, hey, I would love to work with these people or at this place. Are there any internships or fellowships that are available, whether it's being paid or in exchange for academic credit? What can I do in order to get that experience? And also, you know, talking to career services a lot, and them knowing what I was interested in, they would kind of alert me to positions that was posted that may be of interest to me. And that's how I was able to work in those non-traditional positions, which included working at the Law Commission of Ontario or at legal clinics and things like that. So yeah, I would pretty much say that it was both. It was self-led, but it was also support through some staff and faculty and just word of mouth too.
No, absolutely. And I think that's so interesting when you're talking about finding these positions through all of these different means and some of it being self-led. I know that you've had some self-led projects in your career more recently. And we were hoping you could tell us about your favorite and or proudest moment of your career thus far, because it's wild to think about, but you were at like the precipice of starting your formal legal career. And it's so incredible because you have quite literally accomplished so much across so many different areas and niches already. So within all of that, what's been the best part so far?
Thanks so much. I think the best part, honestly, was starting Black Femme Legal. And so in 2020, when I moved back to Toronto, I was trying to think of, what do I do next? And I was actually quite inspired by you, Piper, seeing one of your tweets talking about failing the bar. I was like, okay, it's not just me. And like, just seeing how people were just being so honest, I was like, wow, this is like a new wave of lawyers that weren't there when I was like in this process of trying to get licensed, right? When I was in law school, I actually applied for a grant through the Law Foundation of Ontario. So I knew that that was something that I could potentially do again. And Black Femme Legal was something that was in the back of my mind, but I was like, why is this in the back of my mind? Why can't it just be something that I actually do? So I applied for a grant through the Law Foundation of Ontario. I was luckily successful, and December 17th last year, I received a major grant in which I was able to hire 2 part-time staff and obviously pay other folks to do work, like building our website and creating our logo and all those kinds of things. And I created Black Femme Legal. And basically, it was born out of my own personal experience of experiencing like intersecting forms of anti-Black racism and discrimination and violence and massage noir in the workplace, and trying to find ways in which to heal and ways in which to seek justice and accountability that wasn't necessarily within the justice or legal system. And that's because I've noticed that everyone defines justice differently for themselves, right? Like when I would talk to my friends about what went on or what I experienced in the workplace, they're like, you know, what helped me? Like yoga, for instance. Or I would talk to someone else, you know, like, you know what, what helped me? This really bomb podcast. Or do you know what helped me? I actually spoke to this lawyer through this legal clinic. So basically, I wanted to curate all of those resources, both legal and non-legal, so that folks, when they're in a state of crisis, can access those. And one of the biggest things for us is that we vetted them in advance so that folks don't have to be in crisis and then contact someone and they're like, we can't help you. Or they say something that's transphobic or anti-Black or sexist or ableist or whatever, right? And so what we did is make sure we go through all of those resources so that folks can feel confident and safe in accessing those. So I guess that was my biggest accomplishment, is like people just randomly hitting me up and like, yo, I actually found your toolkit helpful. Or I share this with my mom who works in a grocery store. Or, you know, like I forwarded this to a peer in law school that is going through something at their law firm. So just hearing those kinds of things really make me happy, because this is how I wanted to practice law.
That's so important. And it's really nice that you were able to earn that grant from, did you say the Law Society or from the Law Foundation? Because it's like one of those things, like, you create what you would have wanted when you were going through those things. And so, as we all know, the legal profession is historically very white, very male, very privileged. And as it's evolved, like, we consistently see the advancement of women, but it's often really white women who are very white and very privileged as well, and have had a lot of support built in through their networks. And so I guess my question for you is sort of two questions, so bear with me. But when you entered law school and began your legal career, did you feel like the legal profession was a safe and welcoming space? And also, how did you find and then foster a Black queer legal community in the legal profession?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So when I entered law school, I was anxious. I don't know if I thought I had any preconceived ideas. Like, I knew what the profession looked like, but I was also optimistic because this was law school, not law practice, right? But what I learned is that it's pretty much the same, right? And so I remember one of my first days of class, and I was in my criminal law class, super excited, and this white, privileged, able-bodied dude came up to me and was like, how did you get into law school? Through the equity category? And that was kind of like my introduction to law school and law practice, right? And so that kind of informed my experience in law school. And so I had to be really intentional about the spaces that I was in, but also the spaces that I was hoping to foster and create, right? And so fast forward to now, it wasn't easy, and it isn't easy to be out as a non-binary Black queer femme in the profession. Like, I'm so proud of myself to be able to say it, but it's also not easy because I know what comes with being out, right? And so that's a challenge, but the benefit is that by virtue of being out, like, I have had amazing emails and messages on LinkedIn, et cetera, from folks all across Canada, literally, and actually beyond, that were law students or considering law school, and also lawyers that were like, wow, like, I'm a Black queer femme too, you know, and like, I've been looking for this community, or how do we stay connected, right? And so I was able to create this like informal group of Black, queer, trans, non-binary, femme lawyers. And it's so empowering and soul nourishing to be around these fierce lawyers that are doing law in transformative and profound ways, but also are just staying true to who they are. Like, it's great that they don't have to be this person or a lawyer. They're who they are and they're a lawyer, right? And I like that. Like, they really have taught me to embrace the and not the or. right? Like, I don't have to be this or that, but I'm Samantha and I'm Black and I'm queer and I'm a lawyer and I'm a lover and I love this and that. Like, I can be all of these things at once. And that's what's really inspiring to see in the profession generally, not just in the community that I've created, but in the community that I'm able to see that folks are creating, whether online or otherwise, is that they are embracing being the and not the or. And I love that about the profession right now.
That is a really great sound clip. And wow, Piper and I were just messaging to each other, just saying, wow, that's the next wave clip, because that was such a beautiful message to take away from this conversation. And we're only halfway through the conversation. So thank you so much for sharing that. And I think that's also an important reminder for so many things in life, that it can be and it doesn't just need to be or. Like, you can embrace that, I think, in a lot of different areas of law and life.
Totally.
I am tired and I'm doing a great job.
You know? Exactly. No, legit. Like,
I wish I could have come up with a more creative and or there, but yeah, that's all I have today.
I love it.
So one of the questions we have for you is about your role as the first ever Black legal mentor in residence for the 2020-2021 academic year. So we are just wondering, how did this role come to be? Is this something that you sought out? Is it something that the university sought you out for? And what kind of work and support did you do in that role?
Yeah, so last year, obviously, a lot of folks started talking about anti-Black racism a lot more globally, right? And as I saw a lot of organizations and law schools, quite frankly, talking about anti-Black racism, I was thinking, okay, so what are you doing about it, right? Like, we need to move beyond statements, beyond tweets. What are real things that you're doing? Because there are Black students at your law school. And so I noticed that there were different kind of advocate positions at the law school, and I had reached out to them and thought, can we potentially have a position as like a Black law school or law student advocate rather? And the then dean of the law school was like, yep, I actually think this would be great. And so that's kind of how it happened. It was just an idea that I had. I reached out to the dean that I had a great relationship with and said, like, I really think that it would be important and necessary, particularly for Black law students, for you to have this position. And further, I would love to be in that position to be able to support Black law students, because this is the kind of support that I would have wanted when I was in law school. And so that's just kind of how it started. And with respect to what I was able to do is a whole slew of things, but like a lot of checking in, like Black law students, particularly Black, queer, non-binary and trans law students would reach out and be like, hey, I'm having a shitty time, or this is what's going on, or this is the microaggression that I've experienced, or I'm struggling to be able to pay for this particular thing, or I'm writing my resume and I'm really embarrassed that I have a grocery store on my resume. Like, how do I make this work? Or I'm applying to a big law firm. Is it okay that my hair is in braids? Do I have to have straight hair? You know, like all these kinds of things that, like, quite frankly, only a Black person can answer, right? And so those were the kinds of things that I was able to support them with. And then helping create a list of Black lawyers that they can contact, particularly in Ottawa, that can support them. And just literally just being there for them, like just being their ride or die, or just trying to just be their support in any way that I could. But also just being a sounding board. And it's really bomb, because like, even now, like I'm no longer in the position, there's another Black person in this position. And it's just great to like hear from law students of how they're doing, how they're thriving. And it just only underscores why this kind of support is so necessary. It's not just enough to just have a scholarship or, you know, like have a one panel during Black History Month, that like consistent and ongoing support is so, so, so important. And many of us don't have that support. We don't come from a family of lawyers. We don't have a community of lawyers, right? Like, they didn't work at the Ontario Bar Association like I did, right? Like, they do not have the connections, right? And networking can do a lot. And so, yeah, that's kind of the work that I was able to do during my time there. And then it ended up being that I was able to teach. So last summer, I got to teach my first course that I created, Intersectional Theory and Practice in the Law. And so it was really cool to be able to like, not just talk about it, but put it into practice in an accessible way. And yeah, so it was just really cool. Like all the things that kind of came to be as a result of being in that position.
Samantha, that's incredible. Each thing you say is just, you just emulate being the person that you would have wanted. And like that, giving that back to any community in which you enter, whether that's Black Fem Legal or whether that's a law school or whether that's through your own work as an LLM student, like it just is a real reflection of the person that you are. Erin and I have had the chance to read a bit about you because you have been profiled in so many different cool publications online and otherwise. And we read an article, Erin was texting me a quote from it last night. I was driving and then I called her because it was so cool. You were in an article in Fashion Magazine last December. And the article is titled, and we're going to link everything about Samantha in the episode notes of this episode, but the article is titled, We Need More Black Women in Law. Here's Why. And you have an amazing quote in this article. And I'm just going to read it. It says, quote, generally the law is supposed to be seen as neutral, but neutrality is often synonymous with whiteness, end quote. And Erin and I were just so struck by how true this is and how it's maybe for some who choose not to maybe see it this way, an uncomfortable truth. But I think like the position you were in at the University of Ottawa and the other roles in which you've held and currently hold really try and dismantle this. Do you mind talking a bit more about this really important truth and sort of how you see it and how you've navigated it?
Yeah, for sure. So when I wrote that, I was just thinking about the law. Like when I was teaching last year, some of the questions that I asked students to think about is who creates the law? Who benefits from the law? Who is punished by the law, right? And when we think about those kinds of things, it's clear, like who benefits from the law usually are white people. Who is punished by the law? Everyone else. Who benefits from the law? The same people who created it, right? And so when I think about like, neutrality being synonymous with whiteness. Another example that I think that's really important to look at is the RDS case, right? And so that case involved Justice Sparks and essentially was about reasonable apprehension of bias, right? So Justice Sparks is a Black woman judge in Nova Scotia. And what had happened was that she dismissed a case involving a Black boy and a white police officer where there was alleged that there was, I don't know, like assault or something like that. And she said that, listen, there are a lot of stereotypes about Black people during this time in Nova Scotia. There was a lot of tension. And she's like, this is probably not what happened. I don't think so. We're letting this go. This is just in a nutshell. I mean, there's obviously better summaries of this case, right? But what had happened was the Crown was just like, you have a reasonable apprehension of bias. And how I interpret that is like, you're Black and you notice anti-Black racism. That's bad. And so this is what happens, right? Like when we bring whiteness to the fore or we call it out or we spotlight it, right? Like there are consequences. And I always ask this rhetorical question that if it was a case about tax law and the judge specialized in, you know, tax law, right? Like, rather, this is what I'm going to say. What if the case was about tax evasion and the judge was had experience in tax law? Like, would we say that he had a reasonable apprehension of bias, or would we say that he has expertise, right? And that would inform his decision-making. And how come when a judge takes judicial notice of anti-Black racism, we don't see it as expertise, but rather a reasonable apprehension of bias, right? And this is what happens often in legal practice and in the law profession generally, right? Like, I've had friends who have talked to me about having interviews at big law firms and they're Black, and partners that are interviewing them are just like, hey, is your hair going to be like that the entire time? Because maybe the client may not trust you. Again, if that was a white person with curly hair, it wouldn't even be an issue, right? But there's something about Blackness that is seen as a problem, right? Is seen as not neutral, is seen as disruptive, and all of those kinds of things, right? And so all that to say is, when I wrote that, all I was simply doing was acknowledging the profession for what it is, right? Like, if the system and the law, these colonial laws that were created, were to uphold a particular system, then it's no wonder that whiteness is seen as neutral, right? And if we are truly committed to transforming the legal profession and transforming the law and transforming the system generally as it stands, then it means that not only is it important to call out whiteness, but it's important to dismantle it, right? And so that's kind of what I hope to do in my practice. But that's what I hope that the profession generally is committed to, right?
Yeah. And I also remember that case. I feel like it's like one of those cases that is burned into my memory. And if I remember correctly, it was like the officer said he ran his bike into him or something while he was getting arrested. Like, there was nothing that really made sense about the story. And so that is a case that I definitely remember from law school, and one that I think is really important. So thanks for reminding of us of that case. We know that you are doing lots of fantastic work and trailblazing in a lot of different areas of the law, but if there was one thing that you could change about the law, what would it be?
The bar exam has got to go. I definitely think that, like, it's an access to justice issue. It's an accessibility issue. It's a class issue. It's a race issue. It is so many things, and I don't see the need. And earlier this year, I was on a panel about legal ethics for the Canadian Bar Association. And I was talking about this, and someone said, like, you know, why would you say that? Like, we need it. And I'm like, do we? Because actually, I was first called to the Bar of Alberta, and there isn't a bar exam there, right? It's a very different process. And the CPLED program, it's been renamed. I'm not quite sure what it's called now, but the point is that process exists in, I think, Manitoba, Alberta.
I think Nova Scotia just changed too.
Exactly, right? And so there are all these provinces that do it, and we would never say that the lawyers that were called to that bar aren't competent, right? And so I think that there needs to be other ways in which to have people become licensed to practice, because it honestly is so sad to me to know so many brilliant folks that are predominantly Black and Indigenous that are not lawyers right now because of that bar exam, right? And so I think that one of the things that I think needs to change, and I hope changes, and I hope that I can change in some capacity or inform that change, is that the bar exam becomes a thing of the past.
So I run a business called Ontario Bar Exam Coach, and I always say to people, I'd love to be out of a job. I could not agree more that the bar exam in Ontario has to go in so many ways. And what's really fascinating is I I, in that role, I get to meet a lot of different people. And so I get this, the stereotypical people who like just graduated law school, are writing the bar exam for the first time. But I also meet a lot of people who are internationally trained lawyers and practiced in other countries for a long time, or people who went to law school in a different country and then are coming back to Canada to practice for the first time, or people who are Black or Indigenous, or another visible minority who are having trouble accessing the bar exam in some way or another, and not through any fault of their own, but because of all of the things you named. It is so unbelievably classist and ableist. And in some ways, I almost want to go, I want to say in some ways it's racist. Like, it is such a gatekeeping mechanism that does no one any good. And something that I've noticed, I live and work in Manitoba, and I've surrendered, I think is the right word, my license in Ontario, though I was first called in Ontario. And there just like really isn't need for the bar exam. And it has no reflection on anyone's capabilities or competencies to be a lawyer. The fact that you moved to Alberta to become licensed, and you're like one of the most incredible people I have ever come to know. And like, I've only come to know you in the past hour, but it's been fabulous. But my point being is like, I have so many clients that are in or were in your situation who don't have, and I don't want to speak for your experience, but who don't have the means to move. They have family that they care for. They live in multi-generational homes, or they simply just haven't worked because they haven't been called to the bar, and all of these microcosm of things. It's, I could go on. This could be like a whole separate podcast just about my hatred of the bar exam. So if you ever need a friend to help you dismantle it, let me know. Because like I said, I'd love to be out of a job, and I just think it's so awful.
Yeah. Thank you for so much for saying that. Like, I literally left a permanent job with a pension, crossing my fingers and hoping that it would work out for me in Alberta. I had no idea, right? But I just was like, this is the final thing that I'm going to try. And if it works, great. And if it doesn't, perhaps law isn't for me, right? And it just sucks that people are put into those situations, right? And again, you're right. Like, I had the means to be able to move, right? I cleaned up my savings, but that was my only option, right? And luckily, because I already articled, I didn't have to article there for the same duration of time, right? But it's frustrating, right? And like, I don't think that it's too much to say that it's racist. It is racist. And the bar exam came to be actually when the profession was becoming increasingly more diverse, right? So it's no wonder when we talk about like, when did the first person become a Black woman, become a lawyer or Black person or whatever, or Indigenous person? It is because of these gatekeeping mechanisms, right? And when they started slowly opening the door, they're like, okay, we need to put some sort of exam in place, right? So now everyone else who has had experience writing those exams, or their family members, you know, were lawyers, they can just pass on that information. But everyone else, like myself, we don't have that connection or that information, right? Which makes it difficult, right? And then we already know like standardized tests and how they operate and the ways in which they kind of train you or condition you to think that is not how everyone else thinks, right? And so that's why I just think generally standardized tests, these things are not worth it. I can't tell you how many people that I would ask after the bar exam, like, how was it? How was it? They're like, honestly, it was a blur. I don't even remember. Like, that's wild to me because I can actually remember the process, the CPLED process in Alberta. And I have like tangible proof. I had to write legal memos and things like that. So I actually left the process with like actual things that I can use in order to help myself in the profession. Whereas when it came to the Ontario bar, it's just a blur. It's A, B, C, or D.
And also like something as well is, between the two exams, the subjects covered, let's put aside professional responsibility, the subjects covered are civil litigation, criminal law, family law, public law, business law, estates, and real estate. Erin is an immigration and refugee lawyer and employment law lawyer. So there's one chapter on employment law in the materials, none on anything to do with immigration. I practice in like human rights and Indigenous law spaces. Each topic in the bar exam has one chapter on Indigenous law. So each of those seven topics has a chapter on Indigenous law. None of those chapters are more than 4 pages each, where the employment law chapter is like 29 pages. As you can tell, I know the bar exam materials too much because it's like I talk about it all day. But all of this to say is it's not representative of the wide range of practice that lawyers have. And the subjects that people are being tested on are things that, frankly, like they don't need to necessarily know. Mm-hmm. And it's really just backwards that like I can go write these two exams and then never practice with any of that information. And also like none of that information is retained. It's not delivered. The exam is not delivered. The studying process is not structured in a way for you to retain the information, nor is that the point of the exam. The exam is a search and find exam. Mm-hmm. Like I said before, I could go on about this and I'm not saying anything new. But I could not agree more. And I say to some of my really discouraged and frankly defeated clients or potential clients who come to me sometimes who have been unsuccessful, I make the lighthearted joke that like some of the worst people I know or some of the dumbest people I know passed the bar exam on the first try. And it has, I mean, no offense to those people who I won't name, but it has nothing to do with your abilities to be a lawyer or to be successful in whatever definition that means to you. It's a really unfortunate confidence killer and gatekeeping mechanism, as I've seen and as you've seen like so many times.
Absolutely. Totally agree. Like literally nothing to add.
The only thing I will add is that firsthand, I don't think I would have survived the bar exam if not for having friends who were very well connected with other lawyers who were able to pass along very important documents that summarized things for me and who sort of like guided me through the process because I was like duck out of water. I had no idea what I was doing, but because of the friends that I had made and their connections and their abilities, I was able to sort of like hang on for life and go through the process. And I remember talking to other friends who didn't have these materials and I'd be like, oh my gosh, like here, let me send them to you. Like, how are you going through this without this information? Because it is truly a crapshoot. And no one really talks about how much money you have to spend on highlighters. Like that blew my mind. I was like, we are at the end. I was really not expecting to have to pay for much. I'm not working for the next like couple months. Articling is going to start soon. Like what? And then you have to add on all these supplies and things to get yourself through the like dark days of studying. Like you said, it really is a blur of just highlighting. God knows what I was highlighting, but highlighting.
Just to jump in on that, this reminds me of, so we're all 2020 calls, I think. Erin was called in June 2020. I was called in August. And were you, Samantha, called in October?
I was for Ontario, yes. October for Alberta, July.
Okay. So the thing is, in Ontario, in our year call, when so I quote, didn't get called with my peers in the sense that like most of my friends got called in June, the quote, normal time, if you quote, stay on schedule. Right. But I remember when my friends were getting called, like Erin and so on and so forth, there was this huge outcry because the Law Society of Ontario was charging the same calls with bar fee that they have charged in all previous years when there was an in-person ceremony. And a lot of lawyers banded together to pressure the LSO to lower the fee. A lot of lawyers, a couple of lawyers banded together to create a network of people to pay that fee for lawyers. So practicing lawyers who had capital and had money paid the fees for deserving students. I know that my call to the bar fee was paid for by a wonderful lawyer whom I've never met. And same with Erin, just because we were able to tweet that we needed that support. But in the spirit of talking about the bar exam and talking about access, frankly, I mean, sorry to whoever from the Law Society is listening, but frankly, it's such a cash cow. Because I remember when the call to the bar fee conversation was going on and people were calculating how much the Law Society was going to make off that call to the bar fee, it was hundreds of thousands of dollars. And all they did was send each person an email at like 5 a.m. on a Saturday morning, say, hey, as of yesterday, you were called to the bar. And I don't want to diminish the salaries the Law Society has to pay and the administrative work they have to do behind the scenes that we don't see to do with those emails. But I'm fairly confident that it wasn't like $200,000 or $300,000 worth of work in one fell swoop.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And the conversation about the fees, that was a problem for me too. I was like, I had to pay so much to transfer my license and then like go through the process and all that kind of stuff. What wasn't working, and had to figure out how to pay my fees. And I'm a very shy person on Twitter. So I was like, I don't want to tweet anything. And if I tweet something, I'm going to bring attention to myself because people will realize that I'm called to the bar 3 years after my peers, not months after my peers. What do I do? So I'm really grateful to have had a colleague tweet on my behalf. So I was also able to get it paid for. But again, like that's also an issue. It's just like, can you say those things out loud, right? That you need support. And it just makes me sad that there are probably so many people, I don't even know if they were called when they needed to, but may have not been because they couldn't afford to pay for it, and weren't able to ask for help or may not even be on Twitter. So they didn't even know that there were folks offering that kind of financial support.
Yeah, definitely. And also you raised an excellent point about transferring your license fees. So, I mean, there's a lot of talk about, okay, we have the National Mobility Program. I don't remember what it's called. But anyways, I'm currently living in Nova Scotia, but all my clients are in Ontario. And I get the question all the time, why don't you have your license in both provinces, or why don't you transfer it over here? And I'm like, oh, I could do it. It would just cost me like $2,500. So I just haven't. But it's another barrier as well. It's not just as easy as picking up and saying, okay, yeah, I can go work in a different area or a different province. Like, again, fees, gatekeeping in that regard as well.
And I think too, like Erin and I both come from places of privilege, in terms of for sure, definitely our whiteness, amongst other things. And I think something that I have found frustrating, even as someone who comes from privilege like that, is at least in my experience, when you tell someone like who isn't a lawyer, when you tell someone, oh, I'm a lawyer, there's this really outdated, maybe, train of thought, like, oh, wow. Like you're rolling in the dough. And that could not be further from the truth. Like it really could not be further from the truth. And I think what's so frustrating is that people don't realize like there are all of these fees associated with reaching this point in your career. And all of these fees are for people who typically have yet to have a career. And it's like, how are we expected to shoulder these costs? And for those who don't have the support networks like you were describing, or don't have access to, or the network that you were describing about like maybe not being on Twitter, maybe not seeing the post on LinkedIn, like it's just so, I want to use the word infuriating, because everything in the legal profession is inequitable. Like literally everything from the day you apply and the fees to apply to law school and the fees to write the LSAT, another exam for a whole other day, and your tuition and your books, like everything is so expensive. And the opportunities you might be presented with when you're in law school are expensive. It just doesn't end. And while those who graduate with a law degree are privileged to have a vast career of opportunities ahead of them, it doesn't change the incredible financial burden people face when they first enter the profession and begin finding where they fit as a lawyer or a professional.
I think that's really true. I mean, I definitely struggled financially in law school. When I say struggle, like I had to get grocery cards from the law school. I would have to borrow clothes to get professional photo shoots. Being like larger made it even more difficult because the clothes on the rack wasn't even in my size. So it was just like really challenging. So you go through all of that and then you somehow become a lawyer. And then the fees don't end, but the support does, right? Like there's a lot of support for, not a lot, but there is some support for law students, but there isn't really support once you become a lawyer. They just assume, okay, you're going to be just rolling in that dough, as you're saying. But again, not all of us are choosing to be working in these really big law firms, right? Or not everyone gets the opportunity to work in government if they want, if they so choose or whatever, right? Some of us are sole practitioners, new sole practitioners, still like figuring out our way or trying to do something of something else, right? But regardless, it does not mean that we're making six figures. But the unfortunate thing is, whether or not we're making six figures, those fees don't change. And I think that those fees, those lawyer fees that we should be, not we should be paying, but that we are paying, should be kind of in alignment with how much we're making, right? So I don't think that it's fair for someone who's making $500,000 to be paying the exact same fees as someone who's making $70,000 or $60,000. Like, it's just, it doesn't make sense to me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As a solo lawyer too, that was like an incredibly hard burden to bear. They did offer that sort of like transfer and deferral for bar fees for a year. But again, it's like just deferring it until March. So now in March, it's like, okay, you have to pay all of last year's fees and then this year's fees. So
interest on it or?
No, I don't think any interest, but it's still just like, okay, like it kind of helped alleviate a headache for 12 months, but now it's still there. You know what I mean?
Times two.
yeah, times two. And you can't put that one on a payment plan. So that one has to be paid in full by the 30th or 31st. How many days are there in March? the last day in March, whenever they're due in March. So yeah, I mean, it was definitely very helpful to have some extra cash flow during some tough months this year. But yeah, it's definitely something that's like on my calendar that you're looking towards and you're like, all right, okay. That's a big chunk of the money that I've been making. Whereas like you said, for a lawyer on Bay Street or at a bigger firm, that's just sort of a drop of the bucket, really.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot about a lot of heavy things today, but we wanted to ask you how you take care of your mental health.
Yeah, that's a really great question. So I've been just like loving the outdoors lately. So my partner and I, we go on hikes quite often, just exploring so many trails, which makes me super excited. I love Marvel. So we've been watching like Daredevil and Jessica Jones and Luke Cage and The Defenders and Iron Fist, like all of them, which has been really good. I'm a student, so being a student has meant that I can read. And so for me, like reading is very therapeutic. You get kind of lost in a different world. So that's been really great. And oddly enough, for me, cooking is very calming. I really enjoy it. Today, I made a mushroom quinoa risotto.
Oh my gosh, we're coming over.
We're going to need the recipe and we'll link it in the episode.
Like 100%. Like I have just been like made a really bomb. Yeah. Really bomb risotto, made a chicken pot pie soup. I made like some really good like overnight oats. Like I just been like just doing all this stuff and it just feels so good for my body to like eat amazing food. that feels good, to move my body and to be out in nature, which is so soul nourishing, to just watch mindless TV and just like be with my partner and our cats. Peak lesbian. Yes, we are. And yeah, like those are the things that really help me a lot. And just being really intentional about rest. And so I'm not sure if you folks have heard of the Nap Ministry, but I absolutely love the Nap Ministry. If you check them out on Twitter, shouldn't say them, her out on Twitter, on Instagram, like she just has like really powerful like messages about why we should rest and like what rest means for our bodies and how we need to challenge these capitalist systems that condition us to always be working and doing. And so sometimes when I'm just like, I just need to do this. I just go on my Instagram and I read that and I was like, okay, I'm taking a break. Or I'm just not going to work for the rest of the day. So like, those are the things that have been really helpful for my mental health and just like staying connected to like friends, and loved ones has been really great. Like, yeah, sometimes you just want to like talk shit with your friends. And like, for me, that does a lot for my mental health. So I'm grateful for that.
Oh, Samantha, a person after my own heart. That is you, so spot on. So we love to end every episode with the same question. And I feel like you've maybe already alluded to what your answer is going to be. But we would love to know, what is something new you've learned recently other than how to make a delicious risotto?
What I realized recently is just that like I literally love Marvel and comics, and I was like, what is going on? Because that's my partner. Like, she is just like a gamer, like loves all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, ooh, not me. And then I started watching it and I'm just like, wow, where has this been my entire life? So if you're not watching any kind of Marvel TV shows, get on it. It will change your life.
So have you seen the new, what is it? Eternals? Is that the one that's in the theaters now?
We haven't seen it yet. We are planning on seeing it. We are also going to be seeing Spider-Man next week.
So Spider-Man.
Yeah. It's just, yeah. So yeah,
I'm just
loving it. And that's not me, because I'm like, I love the girly movies, 13 going on 30 and Clueless. But now I'm just like, hey, Daredevil.
So I love that. I also love when a partner shows you a fun like activity that you maybe were like, oh, I don't really do that. And then they like take you into their world and you're like, wait, whoa, this is cool. Like, that's kind of me with hiking. My boyfriend always jokes, like, I love hiking now. I love getting out and going for a hike. And he was like, when did you ever go hiking before me? And I'm like, well, like a long time ago, but I didn't really like keep it up. Yeah. And now I like love it. And that was one of the birthday gifts that he got me, was like hiking boots. And it was like, I love it now. So I'm so glad that you've been introduced to this world of Marvel, and maybe I'm going to have to start watching more Marvel movies if we're headed into another lockdown.
Totally. And I actually put hiking boots on my Christmas list. So like, that's pretty amazing. We got, like, I had that, and I also put snowshoes, cause I'm like,
I got those last year.
Love it. Love it. Love it. I'm like, I want to go snowshoeing on January the 1st. Like,
oh my gosh, like, that's an ideal beginning to the year.
Cottage in the woods. And like, let's go snowshoeing. Like that, just like,
oh my gosh. Thank you so much, Samantha, for spending time with us. We are so grateful that you are able to join us. And as we heard, Samantha has written extensively on all the topics that we've talked about and more. And so we will link all of her articles in the episode notes so that you can learn more.
So to stay up to date with the podcast, you can follow us on Instagram at Off the Tracks Podcast, and stay tuned for our next episode coming next Tuesday.
Bye.